Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. This week, I'm talking to Marie Arana, an award-winning Peruvian-American writer whose latest book, Silver, Sword, and Stone, Three Crucibles in the Latin American Story, manages to explain a whole continent without being 1,000 pages long, even though it covers about 1,000 years of history. Before I picked up her book, I thought that in order to really get how Argentina and Guatemala and Mexico are all connected, I'd have to read a book for every country. Probably I should still do that, but Arana's book makes the compelling case that there are really three driving forces that can help you understand the entire region: exploitation and extraction, or silver, violence and force, or the sword, and religion, or stone. Of course, you can't really pull violence, exploitation, and religion entirely apart from one another, in the same way that you can't really extract silver from stones without force. And that's the point. As Richard Moe writes in our review of the book, the interspersing of those themes and times can make her book seem like a literary version of three-dimensional chess, except that at some point chess comes to an end. In Latin America, the themes are constantly recurring, again and again and again. To hammer that point home, Arana weaves together the stories of three contemporary Latin Americans with a millennium of history to show how you can't explain one without the other, and ultimately, you can't really explain the rest of the world without Latin America, because, like Africa, it was a continent exploited by everyone else for its people and its products. Marie Arana joins us in the studio to talk about silver, sword, and stone. Thanks so much for coming in, Marie.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here, Stephanie. Thank you.
How did you even start to look at to tease out this picture? Because when I try to think about, you know, how do you explain what's going on in Latin America? You know, how do you explain why Chile is racked by protests or why there was a coup in Bolivia? You have to untangle so many strands.
You do. I wanted to do this because, you know, and I don't want to project a completely negative picture of Latin America, because this is a region I love. This is a region my family is from. This is a region that is full of culture and life and love and warmth and music and all sorts of excellence in so many ways. But what I'm talking about is the very things that move populations and that have actually affected the history in very impactful ways. And what I was trying to get at after I finished writing the biography of Simón Bolívar, which was in itself, you know, it took up so much geography. It went all the way from the Caribbean down to Bolivia, 300 years at least of history. And I thought, well, you know, this is a good broad story. And then I sat back after I finished that book and I said, well, I want to go broader still. And I want to explain something about the character of the people, because there is a history defines our characters, does it not? I mean, we have in the United States of America a certain character, and sometimes we don't understand it until we go to a foreign place and we look back. We say, okay, yes, this is how Americans are, and they're not like the French, and they're not like the Italians. They're like that. And I felt that way about Latin Americans, that, you know, they are not the French, they are not the Spanish, they are not United States of Americans. They are of a very discrete group of people that have been shaped by this history. And so I wanted to get at those things. And to tell that story, I had to fuse history with journalism, because you want to show how that history lives in people today, which was I think the most difficult part of doing this book, because it's you could be accused of being neither here nor there. You're not a historian, you're not a journalist, what are you doing here? But you're doing a very, very broad landscape.
Alternating between the historical state and the present state really hit home this, like, the cyclical nature of it. And I wonder, how did you find people who were so emblematic of these three things, and why settle on three? You know, if writing about a whole continent is perhaps reductive, writing about three people to exemplify that continent might be perceived as reductive.
Be perceived as reductive, absolutely, absolutely. And but you know, one needs to see them as a representative. And you know, when you're telling a broad collective history, I think there's nothing that brings it all to earth as when you put it in the perspective of one person, and you put it in the perspective of one life. And I think in all three of these cases, Leonor, who is a miner in up 17,500 feet into the air in the Andes, who is essentially living a life that her ancestors might have lived 500 years ago, is representative, is really emblematic. And Carlos, having been brutalized in the War of Angola when he was sent there from Cuba, and then being thrust onto the American shores as, you know, Marielitos and the Mariel boat lift, a life shaped by violence and that continued to be violent, no surprise. And then the priest, Javier, who came from Spain at the age of 17, thinking he was going to evangelize, you know, people just the way that 500 years ago his others had gone to evangelize, and realized that he needed to pay back, not to evangelize, but to sort of give, in the sense that priests of the Catholic Church were really meant to give, but never did.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and it's tough, too, because Latin America, like Africa in a lot of ways, is written about as an entire continent in a way that people don't really do for North America or for Europe or even Asia, even though that, too, is colonized.
Right.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think Latin America is subject to these grand myths?
Well, it's the global south for sure. Latin America is different in the sense that it was actually for so many centuries providing the wealth of the planet. What the conquistadors actually established was this tremendous commerce of minerals and silver and gold and copper and tin that actually went out into the world and created global capitalism. Global capitalism did not exist before the Latin American colonies were formed. And what is so special about Latin America is also that nowhere else on Earth, you look at the global south, you look at Africa or India or anywhere else in the global south, was there intermarriage to the degree? The racial mix in Latin America is very, very special. The conquistadors, you know, all the Iberians, the Portuguese and the Spanish, married. They conjugated with the people, with the indigenous and with the slaves. So they created a whole mestizo race, you know, which is very, very different from the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk a little bit more about what you said earlier with the without the wealth or the gold of Latin America, global capitalism wouldn't exist, because in so many ways, South America did provide the engine for that. And the relationship with the other commodities that fueled it is also fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And one feeds the other in a way. And it's so interesting. You go to places that are thriving like Uruguay Or Costa Rica, and they will say, well, you know, the reason Uruguay is doing so well is because they've never had anything to offer, you know, no minerals, no agriculture, you know, and basically it's now a technological marvel, but it's not anything that anybody wants to excavate, you know. So the commodities in Latin America have always been shipped out. I mean, Latin America's always been bled of its wealth. It's sugar, indigo, cotton, tobacco, you know, all of these things that have been chocolate that have been reaped really from the soils of Latin America and sent away. And that has been the relationship of Latin America to the world. It's never quite gotten out of it. And still, you know, even when they thrust the Spanish off their shores and sent them, you know, staggering back to Spain, what happened then is it became the colony of everywhere else, of the United States, of Canada, now of China. It's sort of an endless cycle. And the reason is because the people who are in power, the elite very often, and the governments just sell it away, give it away, because it's a way to keep themselves rich and keep the hierarchy the way that it is. It's a classic case of, you know, an extractive society.
Yeah, well, and it's an extractive society where the class struggle has never been, I think, more emphasized,
yeah,
just because of the sheer quantity of stuff that's being pulled from the earth or grown on top of it.
Right. It's remarkable to me that, you know, we don't often realize and we don't stop to think. I think people are doing more of this thinking, but we don't stop to think where things come from. You know, the gold that's sold in the counters of Tiffany and Cartier come from the illegal mines in the Amazon and the Andes. And the people are living as if the way that their ancestor lived 500 years ago. It's very primitive situations, particularly because illegal mining is now the big earner. I mean, it actually out-earns the legal mining throughout Latin America.
Yeah, it's not just the illegal mining sites, right? Even perfectly legal mining sites, what was the statistic? Like more than 70, sometimes even 80-ish more percent of the wealth is taken by these multinational companies and not actually kept in the country itself.
That's correct. That is correct. And also what they leave behind. And what they leave behind is, and they're the big mine out of Cajamarca in Peru, which was absolutely stopped for years because the communities were finding that, you know, the mercury and the cyanide poisoning in the water was just untenable. There was proof and evidence that this was happening. And the corporation just had to shut down for a while. So what they leave behind is also just as important as the ravaging of what they take out.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you talk about in the end of your book how until we understand the ghosts in the machine, the victims of our collective amnesia, we cannot hope to understand the region as it is now. And I think that's really evocative. And it, especially when you look at something like gold and silver, so many of the patterns are the same as they were 1,000 years ago. But there are some differences. So the resistance you're talking about to that mine in Peru didn't happen when the Spanish came in and conquered the Inca.
No, of course, it couldn't happen.
Yeah.
There were no labor laws. There were no there were no environmental protection efforts at all. So it was just rampant exploitation. To the loss of great many lives when you think of the mercury mines throughout Latin America. Mercury mines are, of course, lethal, and one doesn't live long doing that kind of mining. And that mining was enforced. I mean, people were enslaved and taken great distances to do that. So it's a very, very dark story, dark history.
Do those ghosts still linger, do you think?
I think so. I think there is this sense that Latin America gives itself away. I think it prostitutes itself very often and is made to prostitute itself really by leaders and, you know, the dictators, la mano dura, what we call the iron hand that often comes in and enforces this, but very often just by the elite, you know, who happen to own everything and have the money and the wherewithal. The good news is that there's this rising middle class. It's a very fragile middle class that hasn't been there before. But in the last, certainly in my lifetime, there has been this rising middle class with very high expectations now of, you know, now that they've moved this far, that they can move more. But there's always this sense, you know, that the sky is going to fall, mm-hmm. that either there was going to be a rebellion, there's going to be a terrorist movement, there's going to be a clampdown by the military, or some sort of dictatorial rule. And of course, we see that happening now. This before I even wrote the book, that cycle that was going on and has gone on historically has burst onto the scene today. I mean, just what's been going on in Bolivia, what's been going on in Chile, mm-hmm. and one place after another, Mexico, you know, these cycles come back. And it's really not until they think Latin Americans, and I count myself among them, I'm dual citizenship and very loyal to my birth country, Peru, until we realize that we have to look these things in the face and we have to address the corruption and address the classism and the rank poverty that we subject people to in order to create this labor force, mm-hmm. To keep things going and keep the commerce moving out.
So what do you think that this fragile middle class, as you put it, what do you think that they have to offer differently from the other pools of people who have tried to struggle against corruption, have tried to struggle against dictatorship or fascism in the past?
Well, I think when you accomplish a climb of that kind, and I know I have many friends and many acquaintances who are menial laborers, or domestic, or people who work with their hands, and they have managed to raise children who have gone on to graduate from college and get master's degrees, which is an astonishing feat in Latin America. The actual new credence in education and the fact that that can move you to a completely new stratum of life is this new enlightenment that has happened among the poor. This is in many ways why evangelical churches are making great strides in Latin America, because, you know, the Catholic Church has always said, you know, blessed are the poor, for they will inherit the earth, but not in this lifetime, you know, someday, but not in this lifetime. There's always this sense that that they're the good people, but that we're not going to make them less poor. The evangelical church does. It says, you know, we can make you prosper, and you can be born again completely, and you can, you know, shake the corruption, stop lying, stop drinking, stop womanizing, and make yourself a better person. This is very appealing. In Brazil now, 20% mm-hmm. of the Brazilians count themselves as evangelicals. This has a great appeal, and I think it has a great appeal to the rising middle class that thinks, well, you know, I'm going to be richer. I'm going to make my children richer, and I'm going to do it by being a better person. And this is kind of a sea change in Latin America that's happening. The Catholic Church is very worried that it is losing as many people as it has.
Yeah, well, and religion is one of the crucibles in your title.
The stone. And I call it stone because in the indigenous world, the highest expression of the Earth Mother, which was really the goddess nature that has made us all, the most concentrated expression of that was hard stone. And stone was worshipped. All the worshipped objects of the temples were made of stone. And then, of course, when the Spanish conquistadors came, they slapped their stone on the temples, the stone temples of the indigenous. And stone really became an expression in the Catholic way of, you know, we now own your spirit. And you can see the big cathedral in Mexico is built right on top of the adoratorium of Montezuma. And they took the rocks and built their church from the rocks of the temple. The same thing, exactly the same, you know, many thousands of miles away in Cusco, in Peru, the Spanish took the stone from the Temple of Gold and built their cathedral right on top of it.
Yeah, I mean, and it is so pervasive in that conquest. Mm-hmm. You know, it was often used as the grounds for why the Spanish were investigating what was going on in South America, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Even though it was quickly abandoned, of course.
The conquistadors quickly learned that in order to keep the crown believing in the whole conquest and colonization of the Americas, they had to take priests with them because this was not a search for gold. If you could persuade people that you had a priest by your side. So the priests were really walking with a conquest and were very much on the side of power.
We've talked now directly about two of your three crucibles, silver and stone. And the third one, the sword, really runs beneath those two, violence. So how do you even begin to tell the story of how violence created Latin America and permeates the other stories you tell?
Well, you have to begin with the fact that in order to be an extractive society, you have to lord over a population. You have to lord over a vast labor force, and you have to keep that labor force down. And you do that by violent means, and that was always the way, was by violent means. The amount of just sort of reckless loss of life in the course of building the wealth that was eventually shipped out and made, you know, made Manila rich and made Peking rich and made, you know, the Europe rich, was really done on the backs of the indigenous and eventually on the backs of slave labor, because what happened, of course, with this tremendous genocide, that kind of, you know, this more than decimation, just absolute wreckage of a population, they eventually had to start shipping in slaves from Africa. And violence became, you know, part of the culture, because then, of course, when you have these the dictatorial rules that come up and spring up, that is, you rule with la mano dura, with the iron hand, with violence. And when you rebel with violence. And right. So we have this history of organized violence. It's not random violence that you might find somebody, you know, shooting up a grocery store or you know, London Bridge, sort of knifing in out of the blue. This is organized violence in which you have a drug cartel doing the violence, or you have a rebel group or a terrorist group or the military dictatorship. And so it's a very different kind of violence. And we lived with it to the extent that 10 of the most murderous cities on earth are all in Latin America.
Right. You know. I think it's really apparent when you look back to point the finger at countries like Spain or, you know, financiers in England bankrolling all of these dictatorships. But far too infrequently, I think, especially today when we have this influx of immigrants coming up from Latin America, do we think about the role of the United States in it? And I was really kind of shocked to see how far back it went. You know,
yeah.
I think Operation Condor, thankfully, is relatively well known, mm-hmm. but it goes back to Taft.
Oh, you know, yes.
And Jefferson.
Right.
The quotes are astonishing. So Taft said, "The whole hemisphere will be ours, in fact, as by virtue of our superiority of race, it already is ours morally," which yeah. is basically the same thing Jefferson said, which was we should snatch South America piece by piece.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
That was always the intent was, you know, eventually it's going to be ours. You read the literature of the founders, and they were incredibly dismissive. John Adams was, you know, very, very critical, and found them not only immoral, but, you know, lazy and worthless, really. And that sort of attitude, you know, went on to the extent that the U.S. freely went down to change governments or to occupy, because, of course, it either had gas interests or it had copper interests or it had sugar interests. Whatever those interests were, they needed to be protected. And they were protected by violent means. So the U.S. had a very black hand in that history as well.
How would you sketch out the relationship between these forces that you're writing about and our current influx of immigration?
Well, it's the chickens have come home to roost sort of thing, to use a cliche. Central America, particularly Honduras and Guatemala, Nicaragua, all of these countries that have been directly affected by American intervention in many, many ways. And they are now suffering really appalling societal violence. And it is, to my mind, it is incumbent on us to think about our own history down there and why that has created an influx. It's not just, you know, people pouring over the border. There's a lot of history to it. And people forget as well that these lands, you know, New Mexico and Texas, and these were originally Hispanic lands. They became part of the U.S. only in the mid-1800s. People at the border say, you know, we didn't cross the border. The border crossed us, in a sense, because these were lands. They have, the families were split up when that border was created. So these are people who are tied by blood. It's a long history. It needs to be understood. We're remarkably, I think, in the United States of America, adamantly ignorant about Latin America. That has always disturbed me, which is why that's what I'm constantly writing about.
We barely scratched the surface of the Latin American story. So for more, you'll have to check out Maria Rana's book, Silver, Sword, and Stone. We'll be back next week. Till then, take care and stay sharp.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.